Plastic bag drifting through the wind, wanting to start again. Do you ever feel this so paper thin, like a house of cards, one blow from caving in? Do you ever feel already buried deep, 6 feet under screens and no one seems to hear a thing? Do you know that there's still a chance for you, 'cause there's a spark in you, you just gotta ignite the light and let it shine just on the night, like the 4th of July. 'Cause baby you're a firework, come on show them what you work, make them go as you shoot across the sky. Hello, my darlings. How are you? Welcome to Sit a Spell. I am your host, Lisa Lee, and it is Wednesday, May 30th. Can you believe that May is gone? This is the last day of May, and I can't even believe that it's gone. What happened to the month? It's like it was yesterday. It was, what, December? I swear to God, time is going so fast. So, welcome to the show. I've got a fantastic lineup for you. I've got new spells for you. Our theme today is angels, so that'll be fun. What else? I've got the moon. I've got a couple of pieces of news for you, and I have got the most phenomenal guest for you tonight. Tonight we have Scotty Roberts. He has written numerous books. We're going to talk about the Nephilim. He is an expert on angels and all of that. So I've just got this really great show lined up for you. It is going to be a blast. So sit back, have a glass of wine, have a cup of tea, have a beer, have some ice water. I don't care what you have, but sit back and relax and enjoy the show.
What's in the news?
About 500 people are killed every year in Dar es Salaam, in the country, for being suspected of practicing witchcraft. A new report has said that in 2011, the Human Rights Report prepared by the Legal and Human Rights Center, the LHRC, indicates that for the last 6 years, a total of 3,000 people, mostly elderly, were murdered by fearful neighbors who believed them to be witches. The report has cited witchcraft killings as among the leading factors in violation of the rights to life, mostly last year. Other leading factors include mob justice, extrajudicial killings, and road accidents, said the LHRC Executive Director Helen Kijo Bizimba. Oh boy. Thousands of people lose their lives because they are suspected of engaging in witchcraft. The leading regions for it still remained Manzwa and Shinagwa. For instance, 242 people were killed for such reasons in Shinagwa from January 2010 to June 2011. Road accidents also remained major factors of violation of the rights, as statistics show that the number of people who lost their lives in road accidents rose from 3,582 in 2010 to 3,981 in 2011. People are still getting murdered and killed for practicing the craft, and honestly, probably most of those people don't actually practice the craft. They're just accused of it and killed for it. I just find in today's day and age, I just find that shocking. Next story, maids use witchcraft on food to impress employers, police said. In Dubai, some maids are using a form of witchcraft in which they mix their employers' food and drink with urine and menstrual blood in a gross, misguided effort to impress them, police said yesterday. While the practice is not thought to be widespread, police say that at least 4 incidents have been reported in Dubai so far this year. Cases have included maids mixing nails, hair, blood, and urine with food and stirring drinks with used underwear, believing By doing so, they'll be able to win the favor of and influence their employers. In some cases, the maids have splashed urine across the entrances of various rooms and houses. We are always investigating such cases, said Lieutenant Colonel Ahmed El Mary, the head of the CID. The majority do it out of belief that it will recapture their employer's heart and make them pay extra incentives and give them gifts. He said that the practice was not confined to any particular nationality or set of beliefs, and that the women involved were usually charged with endangering the lives of others. Well, yes, because you're peeing in their food. At the beginning of the month, police arrested a maid from an unnamed Asian country who admitted mixing her urine with the food and drink of the Emirati family who employed her in their home in Al Rashidiyah. I apologize if I butchered that name. The family became suspicious of the strange smell and taste of their food. Yeah, really? And drinks, and reported the case to the police. The maid confessed to carrying out the practice throughout the 4 months that she'd been employed by the family. She also led us to the urine bottle, which she had hidden in her room, said the colonel. As part of the belief, the urine needs to be stored for 1 week before being used. Or before used to be effective. He said in that case, in that such case, police, I'm sorry, I'm just laughing at this, sorry. Police tended to rely on confessions from the maids, but in others, a sample of foods were sent to forensics for testing. In such cases, we find really terrible things in the food, he said. While the majority of the witchcraft related to the cases police dealt with were of maids motivated by the desire to impress their employers, there are also cases in which they were seeking revenge for poor treatment. Again, you don't piss in people's food. Anyway, there were some employers who deal with the maids in inhuman and harsh manners and make them work harder under the heat for many hours. The maids start developing silent hatreds for the consequences they are, and as a consequence, they try to either abuse the children or carry out black magic. He said hair, blood, and urine had also been found in children's milk. Oh, people. Giving an example of the cruelty of some employers, the colonel recalled a case of an Arab woman in her 40s who lodged a complaint with that her maid had stolen 30,000, it's not dollars, but whatever their thing is, in jewelry and cash before running away. When the police tracked down the maid, who was from an unnamed African country in her 30s, they found bruises and burn marks all over her body where her employer had abused her. He said the investigation showed the maid had not stolen anything. Wow. Just from a health and safety standard or standpoint, don't piss in people's food or put your blood in there or your nails or anything like that. That's quite disgusting. Okay, on a happier note, getting your witchcraft and wizardry on for free. Got a Kindle and an Amazon Prime membership and want to read the Harry Potter books again? Starting June 19th, people who can answer yes to those questions can read all seven of J.K. Rowling's volumes for free through Amazon. The British bestselling author agreed to offer her one free Kindle version of the Harry Potter title a month through Amazon's lending library, which is only accessible to users with the Amazon Prime membership. Currently, Amazon's e-library is stocked with 145,000 titles, and the users can download one of those titles per month to any of the Amazon lines of Kindles. Amazon Prime membership costs $79 per year and includes free shipping on physical orders and online video streaming. So technically, the titles aren't totally free, but if you order from Amazon frequently or watch the movies from Amazon's streaming service, then the lending library just becomes a bonus. Rowling refused to allow the Harry Potter series to be sold electronically for years. By some reports, that resistance came from a fear that the novels would be pirated more easily. Only this March were the readers finally able to access the young adult novels from online bookstores, so the news that Rowling has permitted Amazon to lend the books out for free electronically represent a significant shift in attitude towards electronic copies. Many other publishers have also resisted plans for the lending library, fearing readers won't buy more books if they can just grab the loaners. But Amazon's most recent license acquisitions, including The Hunger Games and Water for Elephants, which was a great movie, reveal that the company's commitment to its e-library idea, whether big publishers or not, is awesome. So, if you want to read Harry Potter again for free, if you've got a Kindle, you know where to go. And that is your news for the day, my darlings.
The world can be a scary and unpredictable place. It's easy to feel like you have no control over the safety and well-being of your family. There are steps you can take today, now, to gain control. Visit myfamilyissafe.com for complete step-by-step instructions for building survival kits for each member of your family, your home, and your cars. Detailed shopping lists make the kit building process a snap. MyFamilyIsSafe.com. Prepare. Protect. Survive. The safety of our loved ones is our greatest concern. Visit MyFamilyIsSafe.com right now. Control is available. Moongazer.
Okay, my darlings, our moon is waxing. Means it's the moon of endings. The span is 10 and a half to 14 days after the new moon. The moon appears to be more than one half, but not fully illuminated by the direct sunlight. The fraction of the moon's disk that is illuminated is increasing, and it's for positive activities, patience, preparation for full moon energies, and your goals are to tie off the loose ends. Gestation period may appear to as a pause related to the movements that shoot through the earth. Movements and actions may not be visible, but it is occurring. Should your new ideas or project come to an impasse, this might be broken at the full moon. Why do spells work with the moon? The moon phase is the proper moon phase is the key to success in many spell castings. There are many spells that I do on the very night of like a full moon for maximum effect and potency. Just as farmers may plant their seedlings during the moon affects everything and can affect our moods and our actions. Ever notice that people seem to be more like wound up and crazy during a full moon, or your animals? I know Ebony, who is Karen's very sweet puppy, she goes nuts around the full moon. So I see it all the time. There's four phases of the moon: the new moon, the waxing moon, the full moon, and the waning moon. Each of these phases has a 7-day period for doing magic, or for doing like all of your magical workings. If you add these phases up, it comes to the comes up with a 28-day lunar month. The time period for each phase is 3 days before to 3 days after. And this kind of gives you plenty of time to plan and do your spell casting. Not everyone can plan on doing magic on one certain day. Let's just be serious. That's unrealistic. So this kind of opens up the window of opportunity for those of you, or I should say those of us, with super busy schedules. So the new moon, this is a phase that is very similar to a waning moon, and it's used to rid oneself of things. The waxing moon. This phase is for doing spells that might increase your gain, such as money or, you know, power, you know, material things. The full moon, this is where I do most of my important stuff. My belief is that magic is much more powerful during this phase. I'm always telling you, do your full moon wishes and stuff like that. Most people, like my friends, only consider the full moon to be the actual day that it is the fullest and marked on the calendar. But they don't understand that the moon has the same influence for, you know, that 3 day, it's technically a 7 day period, so 3 days before and 3 days after. So I prefer to work on the full moon, you know, when it's at its fullest, but let's face it, sweethearts, we are all busy, 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 and it's not realistic. So the waning moon, this phase is normally for spells that are to do away with things or make things go away, like making an enemy go away or slander, you know, lies. It's getting rid of stuff. So I really like working with the moon. It, for me, and you know, a lot of this, a lot of magic is all about intention and symbolisms. For me, I just feel like working with the moon just really adds that little extra oomph that your spells need. So pay attention to where the moon is at. There are tons of websites out there that will tell you exactly where the moon is at. I've actually got an app on my phone that tells me exactly where we're at any given time, and it's free, so you can look that up. Moon phases for iPhones or Droids or whatever. Anyway, so there is your moon stuff for today, my darlings.
Welcome to Spell Intel.
Since today's theme is all about angels, well, I can't say it's all about angels, but it's about angels, I thought we would do a little angel magic. Since man has held a belief in angels, he's also always tried to harness their help and their power for his own ends. There are generally two ways in which believers try to do this, and these methods are called evocation and invocations. Evocations are special spells that use a variety of different tools to invoke a physical appearance or a manifestation of an angel. Some of these tools might include incense, candles, books, knives, circles drawn upon the floor. However, the components may vary according to the type of spell that's being used, honestly. Incense is one of the more frequently used tools, as there's kind of a belief that the ethereal smoke is required as a substance so that the angel can make itself appear or be seen. Invocations are similar to evocations, however, there is one main difference. The person trying to summon the angel tries to persuade it to either enter their body as opposed to physically appearing, so that they can communicate. In my opinion, this is a far more dangerous thing to do. It's considered easier, but far more dangerous. There are quite a few flaws with the idea of angel magic. Namely, those faiths that believe in angels, mainly Judaism and Christianity, also preach that using magic is a sin. Angels generally come and go as they wish, or they engage themselves in God's bidding, and obviously not of man. Even the most lowly angels is far more powerful than man is. So why would one think that, you know, they've got the power to control them? I don't know. That's kind of unclear to me. That doesn't make sense. If it was possible to have the power to bind an angel, then wouldn't that same person have the power to achieve their own goals? I mean, does that make sense? To me, it makes sense. You know, if you've got that much power that you can bind an angel or make it do what you want, you don't really need an angel anyway, because you're already powerful enough. I would suspect that God would probably bring down his full wrath on any mortal that was foolhardy enough to try to use one of his angels. It's also doubtful anyway that God would employ angels that were so incompetent that they would allow themselves to be used by man. Perhaps a nicer way to acquire the help of angels is, you know, maybe through popular like New Age idea of angel meditation. This is where the individual tries to clear his mind and soul in hopes that the angel will serve and guide him. So more like angel guiding rather than using angels. I don't know. Just my opinion. I do have one spell for you. It's an angelic spell for abundance. This is not my spell, obviously, but I'll tell it to you anyway. This spell can be said at any time. It works well by accentuating with a bell or any instrument that makes a high ringing sound, such as like wind chimes. Ring the bell one time after each phrase. This can be also done in a group if you want, where each person says one of the lines. It's kind of a long one. And then at the end, if a whole group is doing it, then at the end of the spell you're going to say, "So shall it be." So you're going to state the intention. And this is going to be on my website, empoweringthedivine.com, because there's no way that you're going to be able to write and remember all of this. And I'm not going to lie, I'm probably going to butcher some of these names. So this is what you're going to state your intention. So like, I am saying this spell because I want to find love in my life, or to find, you know, just whatever your intention is. And then you're going to say, "Ariel begins it." And then ding your bell. "Baradiel guides it." Ding your bell. "The Chocolidri." Jeez, okay. Sing it. Ring your bell. "Divas manifest it." Ring your bell. "Elohim wills it." Ring your bell. "The Fravashi better it." Ring your bell. "Bagriel brings it." Ring your bell. "The Havaza watch it." Ring your bell. "The Ishim balance it." Ring your bell. "Jael guards it." Ring your bell. "Cadmiel births it." Ring your bell. "The Habil aids it." Ring your bell. "Michael raises it." Ring your bell. "Nebo ministers it." Ring your bell. "Ophaniel Seize it. Ring your bell. The patron angels devote it. Ring your bell. The queen of angels speak it. Ring your bell. Raphael inspires it. Ring your bell. Sandalphon praise it. Ring your bell. Thrones sanctify it. Ring your bell. Uriel strengthens it. Ring your bell. Vrevoil reveals it. Ring your bell. Watchers protect it. Ring your bell. Xanathanael. I don't know how to say that. Patrons it. Ring your bell. Yariel places the glory of the moon on it. Ring your bell. Zodiac angels seal it. Ring your bell. And the spirit brings it through time and space, so shall it be, and so shall it be. Seal in the air with the sign of the equal armed cross using your dominant hand. That was written by Silver Ravenwolf. Silver spells for prosperity. So, again, I didn't write that spell. I couldn't even pronounce half the names, and I apologize for that. But there you go. There are your spells for the day, my darlings. Welcome to the show, Scotty Roberts. Scotty is an author of multiple books. He's this amazing person that knows so much. He's also a tarot reader, and he does tons of events, and he's just a very, very dear friend. He's like a brother to me. Scotty, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited that you're on the show, and I've told a few people that you were going to be on the show, and they are super excited that you're here. So welcome, welcome, welcome. The latest book that you have is called The Nephilim. Did I say that right? It's Nephilim, Nephilim?
Nephilim. I use that long kind of double E sound, and I'll explain why. But the title of the book is The Rise and Fall of the Nephilim. And it's
what are the Nephilim?
Well, the Nephilim... It's you've heard about all these theories about ancient aliens and so on, and the term or the word Nephilim is used and mixed into that. It's become almost pop cultural in its usage, referring to ancient alien beings of some kind or an ancient race of some kind. And the source point of the word, however, is in the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, the book of Genesis, and a couple of obscure passages throughout the Old Testament. It's also in the apocryphal Hebrew scriptures of the Book of Enoch. It's also found in what once were the lost books of Jasher and Jubilees. And this is the reason in my book I start as a starting point. I go to the Hebrew book of Genesis, and because this is the source point of the word. And the word itself is a Hebrew word, and it literally means, it comes from the base word in the Hebrew, Nephal, which means to fall, to come down, to descend, for someone to leave one's estate and go to another. And it has other applications that broaden. The him on the end in the Hebrew is a Hebrew plural suffix, excuse me, that's tacked onto the end of words to denote plurality. So Nephilim becomes those who fell, those who came down, those who left their estate, and so on.
So are they like the fallen angels?
They are not. As a matter of fact, that was the going, I don't even want to say theory, belief within Judaism and Christianity about these beings was that they were the offspring of fallen angels. Now, here's a point of clarity. The Nephilim, as we know them, are simply referring to the offspring of some weird intermixing that took place. According to the book of Genesis, chapter 6, it talks about, and in those days, the sons of God came down and intermingled with the daughters of men and had children by them. And they were known as the Nephilim, the heroes of old and the men of renown. And that's almost all it says about it. It covers the whole topic of the Nephilim in about four verses. And then it goes right into the account that most of us are familiar with, whether you go to church or synagogue or not, the story of Noah and the Ark. And in all of my religious education, in my earlier days, I grew up in a very conservative fundamentalist Baptist setting. I went to a very conservative fundamentalist Baptist college and then seminary. And the interesting thing about this story is we always knew the verse was there, but we were never taught about it. And we were never taught what it actually is. It's the preamble to the flood story. And what's interesting, the author of Genesis writes about the Nephilim in just a few verses, but is very neutral about it. Just, it's almost like a mention of them. Like, I can't tell you this story without mentioning these characters. And then he moves on into the flood story.
Mm-hmm.
And we miss it in the English translation, what they are, who they are, why they're relevant. And actually, the whole picture of the Hebrew Old Testament is built around the story of the Nephilim. Everything in the ancient Hebrew story of the Messiah and messianic prophecies leading up to the Jewish sect of Christianity's Jesus Christ, the whole story of the Old Testament Messiah is really the vehicle that they use to tell the story of these characters and their influence on humanity. And if you found this story only in the book of Genesis, you could just chalk it up to being a Hebrew biblical tale,
right,
and a religious tale. The fact is, though, you find the same story with different character names, different types of beings, but the same identical story is mentioned in over 600 different ancient cultures, religious cultures. It's amazing. Yeah, and it's amazing. And you will find all different cultures talking about a flood story, a great deluge that is linked inextricably to non-human entities that come down and intermingle with human women, bequeath some offspring, a hybrid race, and some god, deity, higher power of some kind is really angry with this and wipes out the earth with a great flood or some great catastrophe. But in most cases, it's linked to flood stories. And so what I have found, it's almost like here I'm going to tell you like the end of the book, but then we'll go back and explain it. I find that the Hebrew Old Testament is really just the Hebrew Jewish religion, the Hebrew's version of this story. And because when you start exploring all the other stories that exist out there, you will find that suddenly all these different circles that exist that are all starting to merge at the edges. And if you boil away all the dross, you will find that all these hundreds of cultures have a common thread to them. And that common thread is some sort of interruption in the human race that resulted in some great flood story. And so I like to say it's either in ancient times, 6,000-7,000 years ago, all of these ancient cultures had all their religious leaders get together for some big ecumenical conference where they all smoked the same peyote and went back to their own cultures and wrote the story, or they all experienced the same thing in their stories in their ancient past, and they all had their versions, or they all encountered beings that were versions of these same beings in their cultures.
I find this fascinating, seriously fascinating.
It's unbelievably fascinating. Let me give you a few facts, because I know we don't have a lot of time, and so this is going to be kind of like Nephilim light here tonight,
okay,
just to give you some of the facts here.
First of all, let me tell you that our theme for tonight is angels. It's our
angels.
Whole theme is angels tonight, so I think our listeners are going to find this just as fascinating as I do. I think it's, wow. Okay, I'm sorry.
It's a fascinating topic. And, you know, I'd written about this topic before, and I had taken the position that it was angels, that it was the fallen angels had come down and impregnated human women, and they bequeathed this race. The only problem with that theory that's been held to for so long, or that belief, at least within Judeo-Christianity, is that the Hebrew word for angel appears nowhere in any of these texts. They're called by something completely different. And whenever you are studying old scriptural texts, no matter what religion or what culture, there's a few things you have to do. Number one, you have to look at the language it was written in and the logic of the language that it was written in and what certain things meant in that language. Then you have to determine who were the recipients of the message that was being written in that language, and what would they have believed about the things being said? What was the context to them? And so all those things have to be taken into consideration. And something that I have found in this and found very interesting, which it may gloss some people's eyes over right away, when you start talking about the etymology of ancient Hebrew linguistics, people will go, snore, where's the channel tuner? But the interesting thing about this is that when you get a grasp on what the language is saying, it's like swinging the door wide open, and all of a sudden light gets shed in on the story. And so what I found is this, and you got to kind of jump all around a bit in the Old Testament to find some of these things, but let me explain the story this way. It talks about, in the English version, It'll say the sons of God descended and intermingled with the daughters of men and had children, the Nephilim. Well, in the Hebrew, the term sons of God, that phrase, is Benecha Elohim. Now, Benecha Elohim just means the sons of Elohim, and or the bequeathed of Elohim. Now, Elohim is a Hebrew word for the name of God. And in the Old Testament, you'll find many, many, many different names for God. Elohim, El Shaddai, El Elyon, Jehovah, the angel of the Lord, things like this, and the list goes on. But the one name used for God the most in the Hebrew Old Testament is the word Elohim. Now, Elohim, you know, here's some similarities to Nephilim. Elohim means basically this. El is the base name for the name of God, the base word for God, E-L. Mm-hmm. And Ohim, O is just like in the Bene Ha-Elohim, the sons of God, the bequeathed of God. It's saying basically Elohim, El, the God of, and then Him is that plural suffix again. So the literal definition of the name of God used almost 3,000 times in the Old Testament is literally translated God of or among many gods. And I will step on a big branch here. And I got to tell you, you know me. You've known me for a long time. This stuff challenged my faith, and it has actually put me in a position where I say, God isn't what I used to think he was. And I don't come to that conclusion lightly. I'm saying that God of the Old Testament that I grew up learning about is not the same character who I was taught. As
this
a matter of fact,
really
I will
tested
go this.
Faith.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
I said this must have really tested your faith.
It still does. And you know, whenever you've been in something your whole life, and you've found over the course of study and research and thinking and comparing that story isn't quite so. Walking away from that or walking in a different direction or even a slightly different direction, you still get the tendrils of the old stuff that wants to come up and grab you. Oh, you're going to hell. You're a reprobate. You're a heretic.
Right.
You're a blasphemer.
Right.
All of that stuff comes up. So I wrestle with that stuff. But here's the interesting thing about Elohim. It's a word that can be used both plurally and singularly depending on the context of the passage it's written. Again, going back to linguistics. And what's interesting about this, it's a lot like our English word for deer. I see a deer, similar,
right,
in my front yard. I see a herd of deer, plural,
right,
in my backyard. It's used that way depending on the context. And many times, a lot of scholars, rabbinic scholars, Christian scholars will tell you, well, this obviously means, it's speaking of God, the God and the plurality of majesty about God's attributes and his presence. Like a king or a queen saying, we are conferring on our people this edict. You know, that they speak of themselves in the plural and that majesty, that multiplicity of majestic powers. However, you will find in the Old Testament the same word Elohim used singularly to describe God and at the same time plurally to describe a host of characters called, there's a group called the Divine Council in the Old Testament, which we never learn much about either. It's very obscure, but it's a group in the heavens or in the skies. And you find a verse in Psalm 82 where God, Elohim, is speaking to a group called, that he calls, the Elohim. And so it would be God speaking to gods. He says in Psalm 82, he says this, and it's establishing he has some power over them. So he's like the king of them or the captain of them or the head god in a pantheon, like Zeus to the rest of the Greek pantheon. He says to them this, and I'll replace the word Elohim where it's written in the Hebrew text for where it says God in the English. It says, and Elohim stood, singular act, in the midst of the Elohim. You can't stand in the midst of a singularity. It's a plural. And he, singular, said to them, plural, you are all Elohim, the bright shining princes of heaven. And then he goes on to cast some kind of judgment.
We were not taught that in Sunday school.
No, we were not. And so this group called the Elohim, he refers to as the bright shining princes of heaven. Now, I want to take you back to something to establish this case. You've got to jump around a bit in the Old Testament, make some comparisons here. Go all the way back to a very familiar story in Genesis, the story of the Garden of Eden and the serpent in the garden. This is the Hebrew story of the fall of mankind. And what do we know? We could tell the story in 10 seconds. Adam and Eve placed in the garden. The serpent comes and tempts Eve. She eats of the fruit, gives it to Adam. He eats. What happens? Poof, they're both naked. And I always wondered, why is nakedness involved here? What's the context of that? And so when I started digging into this passage, and again, I'll cut to the chase here and then explain my case here. The whole story of the Garden of Eden, whether you believe it's a factual faith story, but based in fact, or whether you believe it's mythology or an allegorical tale or an encoded tale, the whole context of the passage is sexual in nature. And it's the serpent character impregnates Eve, has sex with Eve, and she passes this on to Adam. And this is why the nakedness is brought, and this is where the knowledge of that comes in. And I can establish this. I establish this in the book, in the text, because there's several things that happen afterwards. But the first interesting thing to note is this. I'm going to give you a pop quiz, Lisa. Let's see how you do on this one.
Uh-oh.
We were taught that the serpent in the garden was who?
A snake. The devil.
A snake. The devil. Right. The devil. Lucifer. Satan. Did you know that none of those names appear in the Hebrew text? It's attributed thousands of years later to be Satan or Lucifer or the devil. It never appears in the text. In the text, the serpent is called by a Hebrew word, nakosh. And nakosh, by definition, means this. It means a crafty magician, sometimes trickster, the bringer of the illuminator, the bringer of knowledge, and now get this, the bright shining one. Now go back to that Psalm 82 passage. You are all Elohim, the bright shining princes of heaven. Nakosh, I believe, was none other than one of this divine, a member of this divine council, one of the bright shining gods of heaven that came down and impregnated Eve. And the way I know that she was impregnated, there's a couple of things I want you to look at. When you start comparing to other, and for sake of ease, I'm going to call it this, take the Hebrew account and put it in the same pool, all of these religious mythologies about creation and first families in creation, they all share similarities. And one of the similarities is this. You've got the first couple, and then you've got a trickster character that comes in and either impregnates the wife of the first couple or impregnates the daughter of the first couple, and she always bears multiple births, twins, triplets, quadruplets, things like that. Mm-hmm. This is common to so many stories. You look at the Lakota story. It talks about the first man and first woman rising up out of the subterranean caverns and seeing the sun for the first time, the act of creation. And eventually, they have a daughter, and the trickster character, Iktopi, comes along and impregnates the daughter, and she has triplets. That's just one of the versions of that's out there. So what happens in the Garden of Eden, this bright, shining character impregnates Eve. She brings it to Adam, and all of a sudden, the fall of man. Now, what? There's an obscure. It seems obscure because nobody talks about it. But if you go to Genesis chapter 3 and read this account about the Garden of Eden and the fall of man, you know what happens next? You've got God, Elohim, saying this: "The humans have eaten of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Let us, plural, prevent them from also eating of the tree of life, lest they become like us, just like Elohim."
Oh, my God.
Now, that brought up two questions for me in my theology.
Who the hell is
two
us?
Two questions I'd never asked before. Number one, what did God have against humans having knowledge?
Right.
And, by the way, that is a theme you also see repeated all throughout. Here's what you got. Get these similarities. I'm going to just name a couple. In the Hindu religion, you have Krishna sitting in this beautiful garden beneath a banyan tree on a coiled serpent, disseminating the knowledge of the gods to humans, the forbidden knowledge. And what happens? The rest of the gods condemn and execute him for it. What do you have with Quetzalcoatl, the winged serpent god of the Mayans? He comes down, takes human form, teaches humans the forbidden knowledges of the gods. And what happened? He gets executed for it. What happened in the ancient Sumerian culture, where Elil, by the way, Elil, again, 3,000 years earlier than the El of the Old Testament in Elohim, Elil of the Sumerian caste of gods, the Anunnaki, said to be the star gods, according to the ancient Sumerian culture. They enslave the humans. And what does he do? They place the humans, or they have the humans enslaved, tilling the ground for them, producing crops for them, mining natural resources. His brother god, Enki, also known as Ea, he sees the plight of the humans, comes down to the earth with his followers. What does he do? He teaches forbidden knowledges of the gods to raise the humans up, breeds them up again, and frees them. And he, by Elil and the other gods, is condemned, he and his followers, to the subterranean caverns of the earth forever. Now, Ea is also, I said El from Elil, the main god of the Sumerians. 3,000 years later, right, the etymology and evolution of the word El, as it drifted from the Fertile Crescent down into the Canaanite culture and the Hebrew culture, became the name El, for God. The Hebrews borrowed it. Then Enki, Ea, the freedom fighter, what does he become? His name Ea, 3,000 years later, in that same evolution of language, in the Hebrew culture, becomes the same base word as Yahweh, which is Jehovah. And so you have all these similarities. You've got them tilling the ground. What did God have Adam and Eve do? He placed them in the garden to till the garden and keep it for him. So these similarities are cross-cultural. So you see all these cross-cultural similarities as to what's going on in Eden. And you've got this bright, shining character, and then God comes down and curses them all. And he makes these statements. First of all, I hope we have time to set this case up. I'll run through it as quick as I can. Remember, this is the Hebrew version of this story. The first messianic prophecy, the prophecy of a coming Messiah, happens right there in the book of Genesis in the fall at the Garden of Eden in the Hebrew religion. And it's known far and wide. You find any rabbinic scholar, any Christian scholar, they will tell you the first prophecy of the Messiah took place in the Garden of Eden when God said to the serpent, "And there will be a day when you will bruise his heel, but he shall come back and crush your head." This is reference to the Messiah, the coming Messiah, the Redeemer. And in the Hebrew sensibility, the Messiah meant these two words. It meant kinsman redeemer. That was the phrase used all the way throughout the Old Testament, kinsman redeemer. When you see all these comparisons with these old religions talking about the same thing, and you go back to the Genesis story, and you see Nakosh, the bright shining one, coming down and impregnating, God casts this curse on him. He gives the prophecy of the first Messiah, and then he says this as well. God says to all of them, to Adam and Eve and the serpent, he says, "And there will be continual, constant enmity or conflict between the seed of the serpent and the seed of the human." And what he's established there is that there is a bequeathing of two races of humanity at the Garden of Eden. Eve bears twin sons, just like the rest of the mythologies talk about these multiple births.
Yep.
Her twin sons are Cain and Abel. Cain being the son of Nakosh, the serpent, and Eve, and Abel being the son of Adam and Eve. And here's the way that this plays out and proves that point. All through the Old Testament, you will see the genealogies. These boring chapter after chapter after chapter,
right,
in certain sections.
Yep, yep.
They talk about, "And Abram begat Lamech, and Lamech begat so on and so on." And in the Hebrew, yep, tradition, they always followed these genealogies through the firstborn son. Now, when you get into certain characters that they trace their lineage all the way back to Adam, they never trace it through Cain. And I always wondered why. Is it just because Cain murdered his brother? No, it's because Cain could not produce the pure human bloodline of the Messiah. All these genealogies in the Old Testament, when I said at the beginning that the story of the Messiah and the lineage of the Messiah is the vehicle upon which they tell the story of the impure versus the pure bloodlines of the humans, the tainted bloodline, the mixed bloodline. Now, when you get all the way back to the Noah and the Ark story, where you have the story of the Nephilim, and by the way, Cain, I believe, was the first of the Nephilim, because he was the offspring of Nakosh, the Elohim, the bright shining one of heaven, and a human woman. Go up a couple thousand years to the time of Noah, and what do you have? This story of where the sons of God, the Bene Ha Elohim, the bright shining ones of heaven, come down and impregnate humans, and they have children called the Nephilim, and then it says, "But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord," and Noah was a righteous man who was pure in all his generations, it says. And that will pass you by unless you know the rest of this story that I've just told here. Why, I always wondered, did they say Noah was pure in all his generations? Well, in the Hebrew, it reads differently. It doesn't call him a righteous man. It calls Noah the only pure-blooded man left, he and his family, untainted by the blood of the Nephilim and the Elohim, and he was pure in all his generations going back to Adam. And when you get up to King David, a few thousand years later, they trace his lineage all the way back to Adam, but they don't take it through Cain, the firstborn. They take it through Seth, the thirdborn. Why? Because Cain was not a pure human blood, and the line of the Messiah had to go through the line of King David. That's how the prophecy changed after the time of David. You go all the way up into the New Testament and find that the followers of Jesus trace his mother's line, Mary, all the way back to the line of King David, establishing that Jesus, according to the prophecies, would come from the root of David, and then they trace David again back to Adam, but through Seth, the third born. Why not Cain? Because the Messiah, according to the Hebrew religion, had to be born of pure human blood. He was the kinsman redeemer. And where it doesn't spell this all out, by the virtue of the fact that they keep mentioning kinsman redeemer and the pure-blooded, and they keep establishing this in all those genealogies in the Old Testament, begs the question, why do they keep establishing this? Because according to the Hebrew mindset, they knew that there was something else that had gone on, and there was a pure bloodline that would be pure human and a bloodline that wasn't. Now, take all of that and step outside that box for a minute. That is the Hebrew version of the story of race interrupted. Something happened at the get-go with man. Mankind was, according to the Sumerian legends, the gods, the Anunnaki, found us all in this hominid state, roving as wild bands of animals in the fields, and that they bred us up, and what did they do? They enslaved us. And according to Genesis
story...
would
some of
story,
them be around now?
Go ahead.
Would some of the people with the Nephilim bloodline, would they be around now, and would you be able to recognize? I mean, do they have traits or anything? You know what I mean?
Lisa, I have to tell you, I've missed about two-thirds of what you've said. It's breaking up horribly on me here.
I said, are people with that Nephilim bloodline, are they still around to this day? And if so, would there be a way to recognize that they are?
I believe that, yes, they are. And where you see this story repeating itself all through history, you see it in, and this is, again, oversimplification, but an easiest way to answer the question. You see it in all through the Dark Ages, through medieval times, through ancient times, the stories of demonics, the incubus, the succubus. You see it in alien mythos with impregnations and abductions and things like that. The story keeps repeating itself over and over again. As a matter of fact, in the New Testament, Jesus himself said, as it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be again at the time of the coming of the Son of Man, which was code language for the end times.
Right.
And so you're seeing this rise in all this. There's also a factor, a scientific factor that they talk about. Now, this is speculative, but the Rh factor in human blood that they discovered in 1950s that there was a strain of blood factor that is undefinable by any DNA on this planet, and that is the Rh factor. And this Rh factor in the blood is something that has been speculated or surmised that this might show some of that strain that is still there. It's interesting when you look at all the mythologies and the other cultures. There's one story that stands out. It talks about, you go to the ancient Celtic culture, which is near and dear to my heart because of my Scottish and Welsh roots. But in ancient Celtic legends or mythologies, religious mythologies, they tell the story of the Tuatha De Danann, the children of the goddess Danu, the Tuatha or the Tuatha. And these were known as the bright, shining kings who descended from heaven and came to the ancient Irish, the ancient Celts, and they impregnated and they taught the forbidden knowledges of the gods. And there were wars that went on, and they eventually receded into the Hollow Hills and became known as the Elven folk. And the EL in Elven is the same as the EL from all the way back to the Sumerian culture. And so
Scotty,
you've got
this,
all these
this has just been amazing.
Story and over and over again.
This is just fascinating. I wish we had more time because I think I could probably talk to you for about 200 or possibly 300 more hours because this is just so completely.
And I think we've gotten close to that some days.
yeah, exactly. Unfortunately, our time is now up. Can you tell us where we can find your book and find you?
Okay. Well, the book, according to my publisher, you know, the same byline you see in everything, available everywhere books are sold. You can find it in most bookstores. It's on, of course, Amazon.
Can I say something?
BarnesandNoble.com.
We found you at Barnes & Noble. It was a very, very proud moment for us.
But, yeah, you can find it in all the online sources and all the big bookstores.
And do you have a website or anything?
Yes. As a matter of fact, well, the place to find the book itself, you can go to intrepidmag.com, which is my magazine that I publish, intrepidmag.com. You can click on the link there. You can go to my personal website, scottallenroberts.com, and you can click on the link for the book at the bottom of the page. If I can throw in a quick plug, if you are interested in this stuff at all, we are throwing a big symposium in Minneapolis in October, 18th through the 21st. You can go find the link for the symposium there, the Paradigm Symposium. We have Eric von Daniken, who wrote Chariots of the Gods 40 years ago. We have George Norrie. We have Giorgio Tsoukalos, Philip Coppens, Bill Burns from the show Ancient Aliens on the History Channel. We have Ian Punnett and 10 other authors that are going to be talking about all of this stuff. So if you're interested in this stuff, go check out the site for our symposium in Minneapolis. It's coming up pretty quick, only 4.5 months away.
That's huge. Wow, you've got a major lineup there. I'm going to have to go because if I'm going to learn more about the Nephilim and ancient aliens, you can count me in. I'm going to go for sure. So
people.
Scotty, thank you so much. This has been fascinating. I so wish that we had more time because, wow, completely fascinating.
And if anybody wants to
fascinating
talk
stuff,
to
so,
me about this stuff, they can contact me through my website. My phone number's on there. You can give me a call. You can send me an email. I'd love to talk more about it. We hardly hit the tip of the iceberg tonight.
I know. So maybe I'll have you on again, and I'll just have you on the entire hour rather than just for half an hour. Because this
would be
fun. It's completely fascinating to me, and I know that our listeners are going to think the same thing. So, Scotty, thank you so much. You are wonderful and just amazing, and I've learned so much. And I don't know. I'm going to have to start doing a little bit of research because that kind of blows in the face of a lot of the things that I've been raised on. So, wow. Thank you.
Well, the purpose of this, to provoke thought. So thanks for having me, Lisa.
All right. Have a great night, Scotty. Thank you.
And you too.
Bye. I want to thank Scotty Roberts for joining us tonight. That was completely fascinating. I think we'll probably have him on again in the future and maybe take up the whole hour because everything that he talked about was completely amazing. I mean, seriously fascinating. So I promise we will have Scotty on again, and maybe we can even talk him into doing some tarot readings live. That would be fun. Remember that you are important and that you matter and you are completely loved. Remember to take back your light. And I want to thank you so much for coming and sitting a spell with me. Remember, we've got all of the spells and all of the moon lore and everything up on my website. Just go to empoweringthedivine.com. And in the meantime, my darlings, have a great week. Love you. Bye-bye.